As I understand, he had one son, but George, was it?
He had three sons.
Three sons.
And they all died violent deaths. Hmm. Just the saddest damn thing to think of. Here was a family with all the money they needed and more. And one son wanted to be a, learn to fly airplanes. And in 1932, he was a freshman or a sophomore at Harvard. And his father forbid him having to do with airplanes, and he crashed into Boston Harbor. And the next son had trouble with drugs, I guess, in the 40s. And George, the person you referred to, is a fellow that I knew pretty well. And after Mr. Mallinckrodt died, he tried to get control of the company, even though Mr. Mallinckrodt had spent from 2 to 4 hours a day with a lawyer in St. Louis trying to design a will that would keep that from happening. Mm. And we never found out whether it was going, whether it could have happened or not, because after about 4 months of negotiation, he stopped in to see, he flew his own plane, and he stopped to see his mother and father at Old Forge, New York, where they spent the summer. And he left for Boston, and a storm developed, and he crashed someplace between Boston and Albany, New York. Just so sad to think that they just didn't get along worth the damn, the boys with their father, and they had these three violent things happen to each son, and Mrs. Mallinckrodt was just the nicest person in the world. And bad.
So your election in 1960 then as president, you were really being groomed by him at that point, is that correct?
I don't... I don't really... No, it was, there was another fellow there that was a doctor in chemistry and who was very, very close to Mr. Mallinckrodt for a number of years. In fact, before the Manhattan District, he was the guy that did the first Eager Beaver job on the uranium production that I mentioned. He brought the stuff from Jersey City out here. And he stayed with the Manhattan District until about 1946 or 7 and came back to Mallinckrodt. And he was by far the closest confidant, I think, that Mr. Mallinckrodt ever had. But he was not an imaginative fellow. I tried to get him, because of his closeness to Mr. Mallinckrodt, that Jesus, it must have been from 1947 to 1960 almost, to do the kinds of things that I thought we should do. And either he never understood me, or he didn't think it was a good idea. And anyway, it didn't happen, and he got involved with an unfortunate technical situation where he made some estimates that turned out to be miserable. And the company didn't do very well with that particular project. And it was big for Mallinckrodt.
And yeah, was that the tantalum?
Well, it was
Columbium problem.
Yep, Columbium tantalum. How'd you ever hear about that?
Well, I read about it someplace, one of the company histories or something.
I think that this fellow was a queer personality, and everybody thought he was going to be president, except me. And finally, Mr. Mallinckrodt. And he just wasn't a guy that ever should have a job like that. And I don't know whether he was, I don't think he was brilliant technically by any means. But he was, he was always seemed to be so secretive and have. He would give you the impression, he'd whisper, and He talked to Mr. Mallinckrodt. I think he probably talked down to Mr. Mallinckrodt and put little numbers and little squares and three, maybe, I'm not sure this is right. And maybe if he did that, I don't think Mr. Mallinckrodt would have liked it very much. And then we had this director's meeting 2 or 3 years before that that I told you about. And I really don't know what happened, but I got awful specific with Mr. Mallinckrodt and said, here's what I thought ought to happen and why. And well, there's no use of going through all the horrible details about this, but so Mr. Mallinckrodt and I had an arrangement. There weren't anything secrets about it. It was just an understanding that I was going to be appointed president. And the president of the corporation couldn't believe it. And he was a very good friend of mine, but he wouldn't stand up and make an argument. He was worse than Gephardt. And he couldn't believe it so much that when this resolution got prepared for the director's meeting, he had it changed so that this fellow that everybody thought was going to be president would have more power than he would have had under the arrangement that Mr. Mallinckrodt and I had agreed to. And that's the one that finally got passed. But as soon as it got passed, I don't know, I must have done a lot of things in a hurry. And I think this guy didn't have many people on his side either, because he wasn't a nice guy to people. And I think that after about 6 months or so, maybe longer than that, I said to this fellow one day, I said, I guess you don't approve of this, these things that are going on. And he said, well, you can't argue with success. And that was the last subject, the last time we ever talked about it. Mm-hmm. And the company, I'll be damned if I know why the company grew so fast, so quickly. But within 5 years, and that isn't, I guess it was maybe 7 years, we doubled the sales of the company. And I just don't know why the hell that happened. But maybe a lot of guys went out and did stuff that they always could have done, but never did. And then we made some... Anyway, go ahead.
What vision did you have when you became president and you knew this was most likely coming? What was your vision of what you were going to do for the company?
One of the company problems historically was that everybody ultimately reported to the president. And this was always a wasteful procedure. And it wasn't a big company, but so everybody had somebody else to blame except the president, and there was no responsibility down the line. So what I wanted to do was whack the company into three pieces. And one was our analytical reagent business, that bottled stuff, and another one was the medicinal chemicals. And another one, I guess it was four pieces, and another one was I guess three is right, industrial, medicinal, and analytical reagents. And then these guys would go out and have, and that was a confined, and this worked. And we seemed to gain more prestige at meetings, and our sales started to go up, and there were just a bunch of guys around that were real good people. And the only explanation I can make, as I mentioned, was that it wasn't a miracle. It just they went out and did what they would have liked to do any time, maybe. Anyway, that worked.
But you gave them the freedom to do that.
I think that was a major variable, I think. Of course, I also was criticized for picking into everybody's business. As time went along. One of the major things that I also wanted to do was to grow in the pharmaceutical business. And the company was very concerned about insulting our major customers, because our major customers were people like Lilly and Park Davis and Merck and so on in the industry, pharmaceutical industry. And my position was that we had a niche, and that was diagnostic materials. There's a couple of which I subscribed. Then radiopharmaceuticals came along. In 1966, we bought a company here in St. Louis, and that was the beginning of a whole junior empire. And it's still in existence, and it's grown a lot. And I figured that, Christ, the pharmaceutical industry couldn't give a damn whether we were in the business or not. They wouldn't affect our sales to them because we were so damn little. And we got in the business and developed this niche, and it's still one that the company's engaged on and getting a good position in, an increasingly better position. That was a major change that I thought we ought to make, and that got made, and that was a good one. Another thing we were in was we used to think we were great in the photographic chemicals business, and this was because I guess we were early, but when you think of Eastman was then just Eastman Kodak, how can we compete? What can we do?
Another thing we tried that worked out pretty miserably was that I figured that we had so much experience in handling uranium that we ought to be in the fuel element business as the 50s came along. And we were the first producer of fuel elements for the first nuclear submarine. That was a claim to fame we had for a while. And the I think there was a ship,
the Sabana,
that nuke that Eisenhower had made to go around the world showing how smart we were.
The USS Savannah.
Is that the one?
Mm-hmm.
We made the fuel almost another. Was either, I could never keep them separate, either Commonwealth Edison or Consolidated Edison, that we made the fuel elements for their first nuclear, big time nuclear reactor. And we had a little plant down in a small town here in Missouri that handled the enriched stuff. And I figured that this was no place for little old Mallinckrodt. Jesus, you were General Electric building, not $1 billion in those days, but $100 million electrical generating plants. And here was little old us supplying $500,000 worth of fuel elements. We weren't going to be in that business long and successfully. And we got out of it. I guess there isn't much more to the...
I'm quoting from one of the company histories. It says that you set about quickly coaxing, cajoling, and sometimes muscling the company into the modern era.
Well, Junior, I don't know who said that, but Junior... step was that article I wrote when I first went with the company and doing things like that through the years and getting money to make acquisitions. Mr. Mallinckrodt died in 1966, but before he did, we'd talk about an acquisition and I'd have all the damn numbers, columns and graphs and stuff. And the only thing he was interested in are the people honest.
Mm.
And the guy was just so honest and so much integrity, and he didn't care for the trainloads of facts, but he had trust, and if that's what was very important to him. And I was, what the hell, he's right.
Mm-hmm.
Then we try to do things of one of the philosophies that I figure we never should buy anybody that if it got into trouble we couldn't help them get out, technically or sales-wise. And sometimes I guess I was accused of stretching that some, but that was a good, obvious point of view to have. And we also had a very bright guy who was chief financial officer, and he was a real help in a lot of things. He had very good judgment, and we didn't spend money before we had it. And we had one fellow in the company who said, "You got to spend money to make money." And I said, well, we used to set up budgets for the year by quarters. And then I would announce at the beginning of the year that we're not going to spend any of our appropriated money for the first quarter until we see whether our sales developed. And this is probably not a very fair thing to do, but it worked. And we had so much reserve, apparently, in unutilized skills in the company, that it did work. Mm. And that led to we never needed a hell of a lot of money. But it helped build a good financial record. I don't know what else I can say.
What was your approach to getting these, as you said, these people were probably capable of doing this before. All of a sudden they were able to produce more. What was your approach to getting them to do that? How did you encourage that? What was your philosophy?
I think that I did it unwittingly. I think that I selected, we used to have what was called an operating committee, and it was going on for a long time. I was there since the beginning of our 1960s. And they were five or six or seven people that would get together every Monday morning and say anything that popped into their heads that was going to be good for the company, bad for their plans or something. And I think that maybe this was naive as hell of me, but I think there were six or seven people that were real selfless, and that they would take all this conversation and come out of it with a better thing than any one person had to begin with. And I think they did it. They'd give up their own contributions to the original argument if they saw something else happen. And I think that was unwitting on my part. But I think we did the kinds of things that, one way or another, it developed a spirit of what I call selflessness, and that maybe that's naive, but it sure as hell got us doing a lot of things with the people on the same team. Another philosophy I used to preach was, I said, look, let's try to understand this thing, whatever the thing was, a project or a project of some sort, expenditure or new business. And let's develop such a sameness in our understanding of what this is all about, so that if somebody asks one of us a question in Paris and another guy in New Orleans, he gets the same answer from two different people on the same subject. And I think this led people to really trying to be a participant, I think, that would byproduct of that, an important byproduct probably.
Yes, I've noted that you were a strong believer in teamwork.
And I think Mr. Mallinckrodt, it used to detect one or two guys that weren't, and one of them was at one time a pet of his, And we got rid of him for a guy that was always trying to get himself in a good position, and you're referring to the anti-teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
You don't understand anybody that's been through this tells you the things that they think were great, and maybe under any other situation they wouldn't have been. That's a novel thing about this world of ours, and that there are two major schools of management on this, I guess, still. One group of people say that once a manager, always a manager. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a manager of a shoe store or a chemical factory. I just don't agree with this. I think if you don't have a background of pretty good knowledge of whatever the hell it is you're dealing with, you don't know how to evaluate what you hear. But big companies are run by lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's not always right.
I want to come back to that point. I was at Monsanto this morning, and that topic came up, that today's chemical companies are not run by people who have some technical training and can understand what's going on at a lower level, especially in development areas. That leads me to asking again, now that you're president, what did you do with research and development?
Is that in your eye?
Let
me shut this other one here.
Okay.
Maybe you can.
Okay, that's fine.
Mount Krat never produced any great innovative accomplishment, I don't think, technically. All of our work in the uranium days, for example, were product improvements. Now, some of it was pretty good, but we never did the kind of stuff that Merck does today, or anywhere near it. Well, most companies don't, for that matter, I guess. But going back to your, is this fellow Shapiro, did you talk to him?
Not yet.
Mahoney's gone, hasn't he, physically, or is he still there?
No,
I don't know whether he's still chairman of the board, or is Shapiro chairman of the board now, or...
At Merck?
No, at Monsanto.
Monsanto, no, I don't know.
I think the bigger the company gets, probably the less important it is to have somebody run it that really knows the guts of the business, probably. I mean, a lawyer can run a company and doesn't know anything about the technology, but maybe the problems that get to be important in a company that's $18 billion has got not much to do with it. It's more of a financial judgment of people kind of thing than it is knowing enough of what your research department ought to be doing. How do you find this subject divided around your interviews?
I've not heard that thought expressed before. That's a new one. It's very intriguing. Where did the new... How do you nurture, and that was what I was after in your term as president, how do you nurture new ideas? You didn't have much of a base to build from, evidently.
That's right. I'm not sure that... That's right. I think that... I'm sure you're an authority on the difference between fundamental research and what goes for research in most organizations, mm-hmm. which probably is mostly product development that people call research. We did some of it in the radiopharmaceutical business, but these were taking scientific proven things and adapting them to something that we understood. I don't think that the When you talk about research, I don't know the man. Vangelos, this fellow that made such a success with Merck, who was from Barnes Hospital, I mean, from Washington University, as you probably know. Now, there's a fellow that probably always guided the principles of their research because he was so damn bright in that field. But he also had many other attributes. The people at Monsanto, there was a, did you know Tally Thomas?
No.
Or a fellow named Hochwald, I guess.
Oh, well, sure. We have an interview with Hochwald.
You did have?
Yes.
A long time ago. He used to be a very consultant, almost a personal consultant to me.
Okay.
After he retired from Monsanto. Now, he was instrumental, as I understand it, from him, at least, in working with Kettering on the anti-knock compounds, wasn't it? And then at Monsanto, with this Roundup or what, some other agricultural products that they had.
I think it was before Roundup, I think.
Yeah, well, that's with Kettering, when he was with Thomas and Hochwald Laboratories in Columbus, or wherever it was.
But those are real researchers, and Mallinckrodt wasn't big enough to get close to the real fundamentals of things. And the best we ever did, and I guess this is true still, are developing other people's technologies.
Okay.
Ray Holman, the present, are you going to see any present people at Mallinckrodt?
No.
You just get old worn out people.
We're focusing on those who won awards, and you're the only one from Mallinckrodt that did.
Well, is there anything else that I can?
Well, do you have time constraints?
No.
Okay.
No.
I'm not sure when you said this, but it was very early in your presidency when you. The slogan of 70 by 70, 70 in sales by 1970. How did the company react to that? I think you were only at 30 some at that time.
It turned out that we made that 2 years early, I think, in 1977. And I think that's right, or maybe it was 78. But that's something I really don't understand to this day. We had $35 million worth of sales, and people laughed. Let me say this, including me, I guess. But it sure worked, and things kept going well. We also seemed to have a knack of being able to get a hold of a young company, like in the radiopharmaceutical business that was started by a fellow named Conacher here in St. Louis. And develop more compounds from that, but we bought that thing when the sales were $2 or $3 million, and before it got sold in Japan, the sales were 120 of just that unit over there, and about half that in Germany. And then we bought a catheter company, which I nearly frightened me to death. Up in a little town north of Mechanicsburg, New York State. And their sales were something like $5 million. And I can't imagine me doing a thing like this, but we paid $25 million. I must have been drunk. And the sales now of that organization are over $250 million. And I guess we just fell into a tub of butter a number of times and were able to handle this kind of growth by really getting to understand what was going on. And that was real, those were two or three things that were real lucky in the course of this Conacher purchase here called Nuclear Consultants when it was purchased. It was a blooming industry. It was a new technology. In 1958, I think it started. And now it's accepted and big and growing and